It's an hour on end-of-life planning that will cement our wishes about what we want to have happen when we reach the last phase of life. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. We're also discussing how to improve the end-of-life planning conversation with loved ones who are also part of this process. Are you preparing end-of-life planning documents now? Have you drafted a will and determined your housing preferences at the final stage? What about funeral arrangements? Share your questions where you're at with this process, 800-642-1234. Attorney Alan Haugum owns Haugum Law Firm in Wausau. Alan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me this morning.
So as we get organized, as we get started with this process, what is the top line priority on your end of life checklist? What do we do first?
Well, I think it is just do something. I think it's just move forward. You know, this is one of the things that's so easy to procrastinate about because, you know, Kate, nothing's going to happen to me today. So we can just put this one off. I have other things happening today. I've got a whole checklist. I've got a honey-do list. I have a to-do list in general. I've got goals. All of those things are happening today. So sometimes it's difficult to prioritize a best-case scenario for the future, even though we know in the back of our mind it makes sense and it helps us.
Yeah, so don't put it off. Like, start, take that first step. What would that first step look like?
I think sometimes what we do is we just have folks stop into our office. And I know there are lots of really, really skilled planning attorneys, estate planning attorneys in the state. So, you know, find someone near you and just talk to them. And what people find is they'll say, well, that was easier than I thought. You know, it wasn't that difficult. It was kind of fun. You know, if someone doesn't leave our office with a smile on their face or laughing a little bit, you know, then it wasn't a good day. So you just start. And I think what we usually start with are goals. You know, the first thing that we talk about, people come in and say, what do I need to do? And we say, I have no idea, but I want to find out more about you. I want to find out what your goals are. And we'll find people in very similar demographics. You know, they're the same age, the same number of people in the family. They might work the same job. They live on the same street. And they have completely different goals. Well, good. Then we're going to tailor that. And I think everyone should have something tailored to their goals and what really is going to accomplish those. So I think that's the first thing, is just talk about it. And it might be as simple as, you know, picking up a phone and calling a professional or try to get a recommendation from someone and just start the conversation. You don't have to do anything yet. Just start that conversation.
Someone might say, you know, look, you know, I have very modest means. Why do I need to even decide on having a will or trying to plan this out when someone has very modest means?
Yeah, and I think that is one of the questions we do get. And what I would say is the definition of not having a lot probably differs with people. You know, one of the things that that we've seen repeatedly is that you consider anyone, I say you, kind of the generalized you, that you consider rich to be people who have about twice as much as you do. You think, well, that can't be right. You know, and it is. It's just about every level. So I would say, you know, it's the type of thing where that might be, again, start the conversation. If you don't have what we consider to be an excessive amount of assets themselves, or if you do have your person of modest means, as you described, Kate, then great. Then you might have a different plan. Then you might have a different goal and do that. So maybe talk to someone who will talk to you for free. You know, and you can find that person.
And Ellen, when you're putting all of the nuts and bolts together, you know, looking at all your assets, trying to figure out, making sure that nothing is, you're not forgetting anything, what are some of the most commonly forgotten things when it comes to putting that will together, drafting that will?
Well, I think the first is how it will impact people after you.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a difference between just checking it off the list. You know, if someone says, well, I guess on my life's list of things to do, it says draft a will, create a will. So as soon as I craft a will, I'm going to just check it off and whew, I am done. And that's great. So if that's what you want to do is accomplish something on your list, check it off and move on. You've done that. But think about who is going to be dealing with it. It's not you. You know, that is one of the things that there is a little bit of a selfless, selfless nature to it, to planning, because you know, if something happens that I die this afternoon, Kate, my stuff is going to go somewhere. You know, mm-hmm. it's not just going to sit there. It will go somewhere. But the amount of work that the people who come after me put into it, the amount of money that they spend or that they save, how those assets impact the person receiving them is significantly different, depending on if I took a little bit of time up front to think about it and then to plan for it. And it's not difficult. Like we said, it's not a high hurdle. You know, it's picking up the phone and saying, you know what, when is a good time to set up an appointment? I'd like to come in. We'll do it when the estate planning attorney has a moment and I have a moment and we can just talk about what my goals are first and what some possible solutions are. And then really what's the cost for that too? I think everyone should always talk about the cost up front just because that does impact it.
We're talking with Alan Haugum, who's an attorney, owner of a law firm in Wausau, and his expertise ranges from wills and trusts to powers of attorney, talking about end-of-life checklists and what to put together as you prepare a will. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Alan, just a basic question here. Does a will have to be notarized?
No. It does not, not in Wisconsin. And in every state, I would say for the people listening here, we're talking about Wisconsin, which, you know, I happen to think is the best state, Kate, but that's just my personal opinion. But in Wisconsin, it doesn't. We need two witnesses. And sometimes people ask about things like a handwritten will and all kinds of things. But no, it really needs to be signed, needs to be dated, and it needs to have two disinterested witnesses. So not your family, not the people who are receiving things. But that's it. And you kind of think about, you know, what goes into it. You know, you can just say, here are the people who receive what I have when I pass away, and here are the people who are going to do the work. You know, what we used to call an executor, now we call it a personal representative. And I think that is part of it. You know, there's some things that when we draft those documents, you know, some other considerations. I think we have a few separate categories, you know, and people, if they have questions about it, we can certainly expand. But there are several categories that we could get into about that people usually fall into, you know, several topics that really do interest them more than others.
What if you change your mind about your will, or if you have a life change, how easy is it to change your will?
It's actually very easy. You know, the drafting of a will, again, is probably the lowest bar. That's the lowest hurdle. You know, there might be some other things you want to do, but you can certainly add to it. You know, we'll have people who call up and say, guess what? I have grandchildren. And you say, well, that's wonderful. And I would like to give just a small token to each grandchild when I pass away. Can I do that? Yeah, absolutely. Very easy to do. We'll have other folks who want to, you know, kind of, they receive different amounts and they want to give them to their adult children, perhaps in a different way. You know, some of the things that we talk about are who receives it.
Yeah.
But I think a much bigger concern is how do they receive it? You know, Kate, if you ever really dislike a child, and I mean really, really dislike them, what you should do is just give them cash outright when they're a minor or on their 18th birthday. And people say, what are you talking about? So, well, you know, is there, I think from the attorney standpoint, from the attorneys we've talked to, we've never found a way that you could, that would really damage a child or a young adult more than if you gave them just cash. And you say, well, that would be crazy. Who would ever do that? You know, and in Wisconsin, we don't give minors money. So if a minor is going to receive life insurance death benefits or they're going to be the recipient of an estate or things like that, no, they do not get cash on their 5th birthday or their 12th birthday. They get it on a worse date. They get it on their 18th birthday. You say, well, wait a minute. What does an 18-year-old do with money? Well, they don't go to college and they don't need a job. And so how do we fix that? We can talk about it.
We're spending the hour on wills, estate planning with attorney Alan Haugum. His expertise includes planning strategies. What do you want to know about making up a will? What issues are you running into? Do you have an estate plan? What do you have in place? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Alan Haugum here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing all the details to ensure our wishes are honored at the end of life and loved ones have the information they need to carry on and take care of our affairs at death. It is end of life planning here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Have you created an advance directive, a document that articulates your wishes on medical treatments at the end? How are you passing on your passwords? Do you have a where to find document that identifies where stuff is that loved ones might need after your death? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. We have Alan Haugum for the hour. He owns a law firm in Wausau taking your questions. Alan is with us from Baraboo with a question. Hi, Alan. Go ahead. Alan, can you hear us in Baraboo?
You mean okay?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. My mother recently passed away in September, and she had a written kind of document saying what she kind of wanted done and giving me kind of authority over her estate. Unfortunately, it wasn't notarized, and we don't really have an actual will down. My question is there any kind of documentation that I could get filled out for the state that basically gives me kind of that legal right, that basically piece of paper kind of documenting that I have control of the estate, just so it make it easier to allocate things?
Yeah, absolutely. Alan, and I don't know if you heard me, but great first name, by the way. I want to commend you on that. So, but I think the first thing is, your will doesn't have to say last will and testament on parchment paper with a crest at the top. It really just has to be a directive from your mom that says, here's what she wants to be done when she passes away. Here's who she wants to be in charge, and here's who she wants her stuff to go to. So it's not a real high hurdle. But as Kate and I discussed during the first segment, that it needs to be witnessed by two disinterested witnesses. So if you say, well, it's not notarized, but that's fine, it does not have to be notarized. But if you don't have those witnesses, then what you could do is take a couple of different routes. You could petition the court and just say that what I have, I am purporting to be a will, that I think this covers her wishes, and I'm petitioning the court for an order that the court will declare this to be the dispositive statement, that this is the one that describes where things should go and how they should go there. So you could ask the court. If the court says, look, I'm sorry about that, Alan, but we're going to be strict about this, and we really do need the date, the signature, and the two witnesses, the second thing you can do is you can ask the court how they can transfer those things. Now, if your mom had less than $50,000, that's the line in Wisconsin. If it's less than $50,000, Alan, it's a little bit easier that she can use, or you can use as her son. You can use something called a transfer by affidavit, which is the easiest. I would talk to the probate court about that. There's something called a special administration, which is about one more step up, but is still in that dollar amount range. But if you say, no, the things that she had, the things that need to be transferred that don't have any other way of being transferred are more than $50,000, then what you can do is you can petition the court and say you are starting her probate estate without a will, and you are proposing that you are going to be the personal representative. Now, what you'll have to do is you will have to get either the consent from all of her other heirs, all of her other natural heirs. So it would be, if that was your mother, it's probably all of either your siblings, or if you had a deceased sibling, if that sibling had children. So those folks have to sign off on it. If they don't sign off, if someone disagrees and says, no, I think I should be the person who's the personal representative, then the court will probably set a hearing. You get to go, and you will tell the judge at that time, look, Your Honor, what I have is this piece of paper that my mom drafted that purports to give me some authority, or clearly it shows that I should be the person who would do that, and here's the reason why I would be fair, and I would be the best person for the job. So you have a few different avenues there, Alan, but I think you'd start with the court, unless you think if all of your siblings would agree or all of her heirs would agree, then you could just skip the line and go right to that step too. So we got a few things going on, but I think I think you've got some tools in your arsenal.
What is the best way to avoid probate, which can be very costly and time consuming?
Well, I think, Kate, there's a number of different ways to do that. If someone said, look, I just have a bank account, well, you can put someone's name on that as a payable on death designation. say, great. Mm-hmm. If you have other assets, you have life insurance and IRAs and those kinds of things, you can name what's called a beneficiary designation. Again, very easy to do. For certain investment accounts, anything where it's a dollar amount, an investment where it's money. It's a little bit more difficult with real estate. Wisconsin does allow it, but I would say informally we see lots of difficulty transferring real estate as a transfer on death. Not so much. It's very easy to do. So the person dying, it's easy to do for them. But again, it's not the best way usually for people to receive it. And if you say, well, but we've got all kinds of things. We got real estate. We got vehicles. We have a house full of stuff. We have accounts all over the place. If you want to avoid probate for everything, you know, the easiest way to avoid probate for everything is to draft what we would call a trust of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Think of a very simple trust. You know, people say, trust, wait a minute, is that something for the Rockefellers and the Kennedys? They say, no, not at all. What it means is you can just basically create your own rule book. You can create your own set of instructions and skip all of those things that our caller, Alan from Baraboo, was just talking about. You say, no, we are just going to create our rule book that says, if something happens, here's how I want it to go to a spouse if I'm married. Here's how I would want to go to children, if I have children, or to other people, in addition to children, or if I don't have children. And what you'll find are there's a series of questions and maybe a series of goals. You know, number one, avoiding probate. Most people, most families we see probably don't go through probate twice in a row. You know, mm-hmm. Once they go through it, it's like you said, Kate, I agree, it's more expensive, it's more time consuming, it all goes through the courthouse. It's kind of by definition the most expensive because you do everything, but you also have to then go through the courthouse to do it. So if people say, all right, want to avoid probate, if they have minor children, so, and again, this is not everyone. This is probably not most people, but those few of you folks who have minor children or who would be giving things even to minor grandchildren, you don't want the kids to get that money when they're minors, and you certainly don't want them to get it when they turn 18 because, as we said, you know, we've numerous times seen just through happenstance, you know, someone calls and says, look, my 18-year-old son, maybe it was a single parent that had some life insurance, or maybe it was, you know, whatever the situation was, they received something, and they turn 18, and they say, you know what, I don't have a whole lot of motivation to go to college, at least not this semester. You know, Maybe in a year or two I'll go. I mean, I don't even need to get a job, right? And they'll hold up a check, and these kids will hold up a check for $50,000, you know, and you say, wait a minute, $50,000 is a lot of money, but it's not enough that you can live the rest of your life on it. But they're 18. They don't know that. Mm. So you say, how can we help an 18-year-old? So maybe we'll just figure out and say, step one might be you draft this trust and you might say, I want the child to receive everything and I want them to be able to use it at 18 or maybe even before, but I want them to use it for responsible things. Well, what does that mean? Well, responsible, Kate, you and I could come up with a list right here probably. But I would say, it, you know, going to school is probably responsible, whatever type of school it might be. Maybe a good, solid, used car to get to school, you know. But I always tell people that's more like the $8,000 car, not the $80,000 car. Because you say, okay, we get that. But it might be where you want someone to be able to have a down payment for their first house.
So you set some parameters.
Sure. You know, getting married is expensive, health care, you know, all those things. But at what age, if the people listening, if you said, if you took every dollar you have, every dollar of home equity, your life insurance, death benefit, retirement accounts, every dollar in the bank, and you just handed that check to the next generation, what age would you want them to be convinced that they wouldn't kind of go sideways or that they'd be responsible enough to handle it? Well, 18 is probably not that age, you know, and even 21, 22 would be pretty uncomfortable. You know, for some people, 25, they'd be a little uncomfortable, depending on the dollar amount. Maybe you try to get them through their 20s to say, if they can use this for anything responsible, but then at what age would they not really change their life much if they received it? And you can differ on that, but...
And certainly having open communication lines with Absolutely. That young person is really important to understand what is coming at them and what decisions will need to be made.
No, I think you're right about that. It's and obviously every generation seems to grow up a little bit faster than the last.
Yeah.
So there are different things that they encounter. But I think something, you know, a common thread through all generations is that you learn and you make more mature decisions probably as a 28-year-old than you do as an 18-year-old.
Yeah,
I don't think anyone goes backward. No one is more mature at 18 and then loses it 10 years later. So if you say if they can use it for anything responsible as time goes by, that might be good. And for certain people, they say, well, hopefully I'm celebrating my child's 28th birthday with them. So we're not going to test that theory. We have a lot of people who are concerned about giving things to adult children.
Well, if
I give my adult children that, what are the consequences? We might talk about that after the break.
Yeah, let's pause here with Alan Haugum, our guide to transferring assets at death and drafting a will. Do you know someone who did a model job planning for end of life before they passed? What did you witness that put the family at ease or helped in this stage? Are you organized about this or do you keep putting it off for another day? What questions do you have about getting started? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Surveys estimate that around half or more U.S. adults don't have a will in place. We're talking about the end-of-life checklist here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Alan Haugum is an attorney working in the area of estate planning, elder law, guardianship, and he's with us for the hour. Jay is with us with a question from Two Rivers. Hi, Jay. Go ahead.
Good morning. I understand that a will would be important if both partners in a marriage would die. What would happen to that money, especially when there are surviving children, but otherwise, if one partner would die, doesn't the property and money just automatically go to the survivor? Is a will absolutely necessary under those conditions?
Well, Jay, good morning, by the way, Jay. I think no. A will is not necessary to transfer things from one spouse to another. And if you can make sure that at least one of you lives forever, you probably don't need one at all. Now, I kid, of course. But no, when it goes from one spouse to another, I think that's the easy part. That's always the easy part. Now, we're talking a first marriage, of course, where your heirs are the same and your beneficiaries would be the same. So it's the type of thing where a house might be titled jointly. You know, Jay, you and your wife might own a house together. You may have a retirement account where your wife or your spouse is the beneficiary. You might have life insurance where your spouse is the beneficiary. You may have things like a checking account where it's joint. Vehicles in Wisconsin, believe it or not, are fairly easy to transfer from one spouse to another. So I think Jay, you're right. It's one of those things where when one spouse passes away, that's the easy part. The problem is that we are all single eventually. Either you pass away and your wife would be single, or she passes away and you would be single. So any two spouses, that's the way it's going to work. If you are single, if you were never married, or you are widowed or divorced, of course, that the same thing happens. So that's really where this comes in. But no, Jay, you're right. I think one thing that might change that is, and Kate, I think this is generally the same for everyone, is what are your goals? Are you trying to say, again, what's the easiest way for things just to go somewhere? Well, for me, I don't need to do anything. You know, it'll go, like we said. But I think what's the best way for people to receive it, or what would my goals be? I'll give you some examples. I might want to protect my adult children, that hopefully I never have to give things to a minor child because I live longer. So if I have children, or if, I guess, I'm giving any assets to any person, even if I don't have children, it might be nieces, nephews, might be just people I care about, presumably. I'll give you one question, and everyone can answer. So here, we'll take the pop quiz, the Haugum Law Firm pop quiz. When you give things to adults as beneficiaries, if that adult beneficiary gets divorced 2 or 3 years later, do you want them to keep the inheritance, or do you want them to keep only half of the inheritance? And you say, wait a minute. No, I want them to keep it all. Well, Wisconsin, there's a kind of a famous chart in Wisconsin that is not official, but it's kind of unofficial, and it's made the rounds for decades now, where there are really seven ways you can give things to people, and six out of those seven ways will get divided 50-50 at divorce. And you say, well, wait a minute. If six out of the seven ways get divided 50-50, why don't I give things to people, whether it's children or anyone else, why don't I give things to them the seventh way that doesn't get divided 50-50? Could I do that? Yeah, you can do that. Is that one of your goals? We'll put it on the list. And people say, really? Is that how it works? Now, Jay, that might be something that you and a spouse would think about when the second spouse passed away. And it's really the two of you talking about it ahead of time, not mm-hmm. when the first spouse dies, but when the second spouse does. And you go, okay. I'll give you another one, Kate. Probably one that we have seen more growth in is, and I think this is where there might be more disinformation than just about anything, is long-term care and nursing home care. We'll have people who say, well, how do I protect any of it? Some people think you can't protect any of it, and we know that's not true. Some people think you have to put everything in the children's names. Well, they've changed those rules, so that really doesn't work either. Certainly, and with real estate, you know, then the last bastion was, I'm going to put my home in my child's name or my home in the children's name. I'm going to keep the right to live there. I'm going to keep something called a life estate, so I can live there forever. But boy, if I ever need long-term care and the state comes and says they're going to take my house, I can just tell them I don't own a house. You know, I live in a house. I have the right to live in a house, but I put it in the next generation's name years ago. And that used to work up until August of 2014. And the state said, if you do that now, and you do need long-term care or you do need nursing home care, the state will have a permanent right to some percentage of the value of the house. And you say, wait a minute, permanent? Like permanent, forever permanent? Say, yeah. And it's usually a pretty big percentage. And you say, well, this can't be. I thought that's what my parents did or my grandparents did. And they may have, and it may have worked, but they changed the rules. They changed the law on us, and we didn't have a lot of publicity when that happened. So I think you kind of go down the line with the goals, but I think that's probably a short list.
Well, when you look at housing preferences at end of life, that certainly is there in that checklist. And nursing home care is extremely costly. What you know? How do you protect any of the assets?
Yeah, I think the costly part you're right about. I believe the state updates this every year, but I believe the most recent one was that the average cost of nursing home care is a little over $9,200 a month for the room and board.
Right.
$9,000. You say this is crazy. You know, that's well over $100,000 a year. I think it's about $110,000. So really, what the state says. And this is derived from federal rules. So we are very similar to most states, not every single one, but most states. And they say that you can protect what you have if you do it ahead of time. And then how much you protect depends on how far in advance you did that. Now, where this runs up against things, though, is what people used to think, and I think some still do. You know, you'll have the coffee group that says, well, I think the only way to protect it is to give it to kids. And I would say that is probably not a great example of how to do things. Just because, you know, Kate, if I think you have talked about in the past your spouse and children, and you made some of those things public. So if I talked to you today and said, you know what, Kate, I got a great idea. Are you ready? First thing we're going to do, we're going to take every single thing that you and your spouse own, everything, and we're going to give it to your kids today. You will be penniless by about noon. How does that sound? Sound like a great idea?
Not a good idea.
That sounds like a horrible idea. No one wants to do that. But people do say, well, wait a minute. I want to protect things or certain things. And there's no free lunch. You know, nursing home care will get paid for, but there are different ways to do it. And the state very clearly says you can keep certain things. In fact, you can keep a pretty significant amount of things, again, if you do the planning ahead of time and if you do it in particular ways. And if people say, well, that's great, but I still want to be in charge of it. Can I be in charge of it? Yeah, you can. Can I still use it? Yeah, you can. But you just have to do it. And it's that probably is another thing that we put on our list of goals. If that's a goal, we talk about it. If it's not, then we don't worry about it.
I'm going to pause here. We're talking with Alan Haugum, who's an attorney and owner of a law firm in Wausau. We're looking at end-of-life planning and taking your questions. Bill is joining us from Fitchburg with a question. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi, I've heard horror stories of people who, at the death of a spouse, could not get their hands on any money, credit cards, checking accounts, and that sort of thing. How do you set that up so you're not broke for a month or two until it gets straightened out?
Well, Bill, that is something that we deal with frequently. Good morning, by the way. Thanks for tuning in. The access to things when someone passes away. Now, this might be a bit of an addendum to Jay from Two Rivers' question. But what happens, Bill, is we are individuals, and maybe to clarify, not everything goes to a spouse automatically. Oftentimes, the value of things goes to a spouse. Jointly owned house, checking account, beneficiary on the accounts and the 401ks and the life insurance, those kinds of things. But you do not have the right to make decisions about someone's estate or even while they're living, but they're incapacitated. People are shocked sometimes to say, well, I can't just make all those decisions for my spouse, and you can't. In fact, the state says if they didn't designate you as the person to make those decisions, that they must have chosen not to name you. Well, it's not really a conscious choice usually. So what we do, Bill, I think what you're talking about, that frozen period, that is generally what happens with a will and going through the probate process, is right out of the gate, if you take a will when someone dies and the will says that Bill is the personal representative, and then you take it down to the bank or the CPA for some tax returns, or you want to deal with the real estate, those places say, Bill, you can't do any of those things because those places don't read wills. Every will to be utilized has to go through the courthouse, has to go through the probate court. They can read it. You can physically read the English, the language, but you can't use it unless it goes through the probate court. So, yeah, Bill, that involves probably that, roughly a month of kind of back and forth a few times with the courthouse to get that set up. If it goes smoothly, if you want to avoid that, that's another great example of just even a very, very simple trust would avoid that. Not saying that everybody needs a trust or doesn't or any of those things, but if that's a goal to avoid that frozen period and avoid the difficulty, that's certainly one easy way to do it.
Bill, thanks. Kate is with us from Alma with a question. Kate, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My 95-year-old mother made a will about 10, 12 years ago, and in it she said that everything in her estate would be divided equally among the four children. However, she also has CDs in the bank that are payable on death to each individual child, and they're in different amounts. And also, she did a ladybird deed for her house, so she keeps her house until she dies. But when she dies, the house goes to only my brother and myself. So I'm wondering, that seems like it's not in, the amounts in the CDs are different. They're not equally split. How does that work out?
Well, Kate, boy, this is fantastic. We had first caller was Alan. We have Kate. This is a great day, but every day is a great day. So, Kate from Alma, not Kate Archer-Kemp. Kate, the will is really the lowest common denominator. That's what will transfer things that don't have any other method of transferring it. So anything you can do ahead of that is going to take precedence. If you have a CD in the bank that has a child's name or anyone's name as a payable on death beneficiary, that goes first. And if those are of differing amounts to differing children, that can cause a problem, certainly. If you have a house that only goes to two children, not all of the children, well, when your mom passes away, then that house is theirs. Now, you mentioned you called it a ladybird deed. We usually hear that term from different states. Mm. They call them ladybird deeds in Wisconsin. Sometimes that's simply a life estate where your mom kept a life estate. That's what it sounds like, but I won't assume unless I see things. But if that goes to two kids, it goes to two kids. And the other children do not have any legal right to that. It's certainly within your mom's ability to draft that. And then if her will says, well, wait a minute, everything I have should go equally, well, keep in mind, that's not how it's going to be unless you change those CDs and change that house to be consistent.
We have Wausau-based attorney Alan Haugum with us. What's on your mind about estate planning? What issues are you running into as you talk with loved ones and take stock of your life? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with attorney Alan Haugum about drafting a will, about the end-of-life checklist, and for parents, the chance to name guardians for your kids may be the single most compelling reason to make a will. That's the case for me. Did you use a template online or get advice some other way with an attorney? Have you named a personal representative? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. And attorney Alan Haugum is with us for 10 more minutes. Fred is with us from La Crosse with a question. Hi, Fred, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a friend who passed away in, this will be 5 years ago, and he had named me and one of his children as a co-trustee for the trust that they had set up, and with basic instructions of settling the estate by distributing the money equally to the five total children. And the difficulty I'm having, this is 5 years ago already that he passed away, the difficulty I'm having is that I can't make any decisions without her. She can't make any decisions without me. The house is sitting vacant. Taxes are being paid and stuff like that. But I can't get it moved to where it's like, okay, let's sell the house and let's go and distribute the proceeds to the heirs. And in talking to the attorney who set up the trust, he said, well, you could hire your own attorney. He said, I can't represent you because I can't go and sue the other co-trustee. You could hire your own attorney at your own expense. If you win, then you could get money out of the estate to do it, but that there's no way to do it. So my long story short is my point would be is that if you're going to name a trust, do not have two people as co-trustees. Either have one person and a successor, or have three of them with, you know, two voting to decide something carries the decision or something like that. So I would caution people when they do trust that they don't name just two equal co-trustees. It's very difficult because my friend has passed away 5 years ago.
Fred, thanks. Alan, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, Fred, there's something to that. And I don't think it's just trusts. I think it's co-personal representatives. It's co-agents under your powers of attorney for finances. All of those things, I agree that we see some difficulty in that you really want, ideally you would have one person. If there's a scenario where you say, we just can't do it, we just can't pick, or neither one of these could do it alone, but I think they could do it together, yeah, then you can do that. I think, Fred, that, you know, 5 years go by, it's one of those things where I would advise you do have a fiduciary duty to those beneficiaries, and I think a fiduciary duty may require some action. So you just don't want to ever get to a situation where something happens to that house or some of the assets are being spent and it's kind of diminishing what those beneficiaries are going to receive just because of, someone won't return a phone call or she's a little bit disagreeable. So I think there might be, you might want to take some action, but I agree with Fred. That puts you in a very difficult situation. So, and there's ways you can deal with that. There are ways you can set up mechanisms to remove those people who are difficult. And I think that's the next step is just try to remove someone who just refuses to act.
We haven't talked about passwords or about, you know, the list
the digital
of
property.
The digital property. Yeah. Where do you start there?
You know, I think Wisconsin has the Digital Property Act, which is now, I think, 5 years old, maybe more. And they have some guidelines as to how that works. But Kate, as our lives become more digital, and I don't mean just your Facebook page or those types of things. But what I mean is, we have investments that are, you know, every investment company, every bank is sending out things saying, would you like to go paperless? Would you like to have this experience really just be online and not tangible? You know, we used to be able to know everything about you if we could get last year's tax return and 3 months worth of mail. We knew everything. But that doesn't happen these days. So I think, you know, first use what those websites allow you. They're called online tools, I think, in the Digital Property Act. That's first. But I think even more important to me is put that into your will or into your trust and certainly into your power of attorney for finances. You know, a power of attorney for finances just names someone who can make financial decisions, who can sign for you if you're living but you're incapacitated. So who can sign for you if you're living but you're not able to do it yourself? And then obviously after you pass away. If you don't do any of those things, there is some respite, at least from that Digital Property Act. But we really don't want to just settle on those default rules. I think for the passwords, maybe to belatedly answer your question, Kate, I think for those passwords, you know, it sounds crazy. So don't stop me, you know, but it's, sometimes I say, write them down. You know, we used to be worried about passwords initially. We'd say, well, don't write those down. Someone could grab your sheet of passwords and do things. Well, who are we worried about these days with passwords? It's everyone online. It's identity theft. It's, you know, some foreign country is going to kind of take over your account. That's who we're worried about. They're not going to see the sheet of paper that you have in the home safe or the filing cabinet. So you might just do that. Another one that might be a little bit more secure, if you have a password manager, we think that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that someone obviously would have the master password or have a way of obtaining the master password. And then another one is simply to have two lists. Have all of your usernames and accounts on one list, and we've heard that advocated for. Maybe put it on a flash drive or a thumb drive or something, some separate piece of storage device. So have username and account numbers on one, and then a separate device or a separate flash drive or a separate list with your passwords.
Okay.
And then you can give those to two different people. You can have them in two different locations. You can have one locked up and one open. But then if something does happen to you, we've got both. Now, obviously, passwords do change. You know, certain places make you update those.
Quite regularly, yeah.
Yeah, it's a place to start. But I think if you have some, then obviously the next part would be that the Digital Property Act kind of backs you up a little bit. But and obviously look at some of the commercial password managers that might be the key to all of it then.
I
think there's some things to do.
We have a real quick question here from Helen in Neosho. Helen, go ahead.
Yes, good morning to you and your guest, Kate. I have an existing trust drawn up by a lawyer. I would like to make revisions to that trust. If I make the revisions, how do I make them legal? Do I need to go back to the lawyer? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, Helen, for the question. Yes, revisions to a trust are actually fairly easy to most trusts. There are certainly some trusts, some rare exceptions that you might have not, but I think virtually every trust, you want to make it easy to amend. And Helen, you can choose whether you go to that lawyer. I'll leave that up to you. But I think you should go to a lawyer. That I would strongly recommend, because you want to make sure that those things work. We certainly have seen people who draft that on their own, and they might draft one section, not realizing that when you change that section, you also have to change a corresponding section of the trust. Not difficult, not expensive really at all. It's about as inexpensive as you can get. But just have an attorney who specializes in it take a look at it, just to make sure you're doing it right. We want to make sure everything you do, Helen, is respected someday when it gets when it's going to be used.
Well, Alan, we only have 10 seconds left, but you know, big question. It could be really quick here. Do you have a method of distributing items or personal property or heirlooms in a way that will avoid a family fight?
Absolutely. What we do is we say, if there's anything that you think anyone would fight about, the one particular piece of jewelry, the sports car, anything, the coin collection, if there's anything they would fight about, then we will name that very specifically as to how that works. For everything else, there's about three or four different ways where you can do kind of a rotational system. We have something called a personal family auction where you don't use money. And those really work well. So it's just for those tangible items, though. Make sure you do the planning ahead of time, like everything else.
Alan, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Kate. I appreciate it, and have a wonderful day.
You too. Alan Haugum, an attorney and owner of Haugum Law Firm in Wausau. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.